So there was this guy, I'm gonna call him Frank. And Frank had this thing where the grease never really fully came out from under his fingernails, like it was a part of his anatomy or something. And he had this back where every time he stood up from a chair, it made this sound like dry kindling, when you're trying to start a fire. Yeah. So Frank's town used to manufacture things. I don't remember what exactly, and I guess it doesn't really matter. But at some point, it stopped. And the town didn't really recover so much as it just, I guess, adapted to not recovering. The pharmacies did fine, though, not surprisingly. They stayed up where they stood at open late, and they seemed to be the one remaining growth industry in that particular zip code. And people talked about Frank the way people talk about someone that they've decided not to think too hard about. He's got issues. He's made bad choices in life. He needs to take some responsibility, accountability for himself, things of that nature. Which is fine on a certain level. I mean, we all need to hold ourselves accountable in some aspects of our lives, of course. But oftentimes, I think on a certain level, there's this judgment and this these things get said with a type of confidence of someone who's never really had the floor tilt under them at the wrong moment in their life. And I think what bothered me about this was how certain everyone was in jumping to the conclusion that Frank's situation was just a character flaw that just happened to come with a prescription bottle and, maxed out credit cards and a town that stopped needing him sometime around 1994, I guess. So here's what I kept thinking when I looked at Frank. He did everything the right way. Everything the brochure said to do. He worked all the shifts. He didn't complain for the most part. He paid interest on the interest of the thing that he bought to make the other thing more bearable. And he watched the diner in his town where he used to get coffee on Tuesday mornings turn into a dialysis clinic. And then at some point, his body, let's just say that it started sending strongly worded letters. And the system's response to that was basically, well, here, take these pain meds. This will help you stay functional. Not cured, but functional. And by the way, there's a very distinct difference between those two things that doesn't get the attention that I think it should. I think what Frank was given was, and what a lot of people are given, was chemical relief for spiritual despair, which is a little like someone handing you an umbrella and telling you that the roof's been fixed, right? So Frank didn't really fail the system. The system just, it finished with him and it moved on the way that it does. And the thing is, and I keep coming back to this, Frank, he wasn't an outlier. I mean, he was just early to this whole economic development. And he was a version of this that arrived in certain zip codes first before it started showing up pretty much everywhere else. So Frank was like, I guess you could say he was like the canary in the coal mine. And you know, the canary doesn't know that it's doing a rather morbid service. It's just trying to breathe. So here's the thing about control. The old version, this was around 100 years ago, it was pretty straightforward. If you wanted to keep people in line, you sent someone menacing carrying a weapon. And back then it was usually the Pinkertons, company men. And yeah, it worked pretty effectively, but it was aggressive and loud, and it was expensive, and it gave people something specific to be pissed off at. It also gave people a reason to find each other and organize, which turns out to be the main problem with visible oppression, right? It's clarifying. And nothing organizes people faster than a shared, obvious enemy in a uniform. So at some point, that whole approach got reconsidered. And I think what someone somewhere figured out, probably in a swanky high-rise office, is that you don't actually need to break people. If you can just make their environment difficult enough that they break themselves, and then of course blame themselves for it, because that's obviously a lot more efficient, isn't it? And it's more scalable, as it turns out. So the floor doesn't need to be made of nails. It just needs to be slightly persistently slippery. And I think about this when I see the way the culture war gets run now, red versus blue, and all this constant reinforcement of division. You know, we have this endless rotating cast of things to be furious about, which somehow rarely ever includes the people who actually hold the lease of the vast majority of our lives. And that's not an accident. That's just, well, it's just the architecture. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that there's a room somewhere with a cabal of 12 people or whatever planning all of this. I don't think it's actually that coordinated, at least not anymore. I mean, there may have been a time when that was more likely, but I think these days it's more like there's a set of incentives that produce a predictable result, and nobody particularly needs to be in charge of it to keep it running anymore. I mean, it's practically automated now. So yeah, you know, world domination is becoming automated, which I don't know if that's terrifying or in any case, you know, the algorithm doesn't have an agenda exactly. I mean, it just, the algorithm rewards outrage because outrage keeps people on the platforms. I mean, that's the whole point, right? And then, of course, the platform sells the attention to someone else. And somewhere in that chain, the anger that might have gone somewhere useful, just, it gets composted into engagement metrics. And this results in you being too tired to organize. So then you watch something that makes you feel something, and that something turns out to be fury directed at a stranger that lives three states away that has roughly the same amount of actual power over your life as a decorative gourd. But it's a feeling. And, you know, feelings are hard to come by when you're running low. So then you go home, and the loneliness is still there, so you buy something that you don't need, that you can't really afford, and that fills the void for a while. It appeases the simmering angst. This is a very efficient loop that requires almost no maintenance. And I think what gets me is the maps thing. The way that people were handed maps that were drawn wrong on purpose and then got mocked for being lost. Their confusion was a personal failure rather than a feature of the navigation system. Frank had one of those maps. Most people I know have one of those maps. It's just that some of us haven't noticed yet that the road we're on doesn't actually go anywhere. So when someone finally does hit the wall, we don't call it systemic failure. We give it a more user-friendly or a cleaner name, like midlife crisis, substance issues, bad choices. Basically, something that keeps the problem located inside the person rather than inside the conditions that produce the person. And I understand why. It's just tidier that way. But I keep thinking about what actually happens to a nervous system that's been running on cortisol and financial anxiety for like 20 consecutive years, just biologically speaking. Because at some point, that math stops working, right? I mean, it's not sustainable. I mean, there's only so long that you can run a machine past its tolerance before something that wasn't supposed to bend starts bending and then breaking. And the establishment's response to that, and this is the part that still gets me, it isn't to address the conditions, no. It's to address the symptoms, just enough to keep the person functional. Not well, functional. So, you know, keep them getting back in rotation, keep them showing up, regardless of how depleted they might be or whatever they have going on in their personal lives. And there's a version of this that's pharmaceutical, obviously. There's a version that's a screen. There's a version that's a drink or two that becomes a bottle or two or three. I mean, whatever the case, the delivery system or delivery mechanism varies, but the function is the same. It's basically friction management. I mean, this is how you keep the parts moving when everything's clearly overheating. And none of this fixes the underlying thing, of course. It just makes the underlying thing a little mellower for a while, which is probably the point. It's probably just part of the whole nefarious process. I think about the isolation aspect of this a lot, because there's something specific that happens when you're genuinely alone. Not just physically alone, but structurally alone, without any real community, no shared context with the people around you. So you lose the ability to name, you know, in that situation, what's happening to you. And then the pattern becomes invisible. And once the pattern is invisible, everything starts to feel like a personal defect. And, you know, the anxiety starts feeling like a character flaw rather than a rational response to a genuinely irrational situation. And that's a very convenient reframe for everyone, except, of course, the person experiencing it. Frank had a word for this. He called it the hum. And the hum is this, I guess it's this low-level background frequency of dread that never fully went away. And you could turn it down with the right combination of things, but it always came back, usually around 3 a.m. when there's nothing left to distract it. I don't think Frank was unusual in experiencing the hum. I think a lot of people live with it. I think humans have been living with this forever. It just becomes more noticeable at certain times and places. I think this hum has been cognizant in some people for so long that they've stopped noticing it's even there. Like when you stop hearing the fridge buzz until it turns off. And the ones who hit the wall the loudest, I think they're usually just the ones who just, they ran out of ways to turn down the hum. And we look at these people and we see failure, right? Defects. We look at them and we see a cautionary tale. But I'm not quite sure that we're looking at the right thing. So underneath all this, there's something that doesn't, I don't think it gets named very often, because naming it makes it harder to keep your distance from it, and that's grief. And I don't mean the kind of grief that you get at a funeral. I mean, I'm talking about a different kind here. This is the kind of grief that accumulates very slowly. And you don't notice it until one day you reach for something that used to be there and your hand just finds air. Frank had a lot of that kind. So he observed his community just thinning out gradually, insidiously, and the work that used to mean something that just disappeared. And he saw the future. It would just keep getting quietly revised downward, no matter how many shifts he covered. And I think the reason we don't call that grief is because grief implies a loss, right? And acknowledging the loss means acknowledging something was taken, which is a different conversation than the one we're set up to have. So there's a writer named Barbara Ehrenreich who spent a couple of years in the early 2000s working the minimum wage jobs and trying to live on what they paid. And she was documenting the texture of that life from the inside as a writer. And what she found wasn't really people failing. It was math that was never designed to work out in the first place, like structurally. So the gap between what things cost and what the work paid wasn't an accident of circumstance. It was just the gap. Now, Frank knew the gap. I mean, he'd been living in it for so long that it started to feel like just the natural shape of things. I mean, it had become normalized. Eric Fromm wrote something in the 1950s that I keep stumbling upon. And it's this idea that whole societies can be sick. Not metaphorically speaking, actually sick. And that the fact that everyone around you shares the same dysfunction doesn't make it healthy. It just makes it like emotional wallpaper. Which is an uncomfortable thing to sit with, because it means that being well adjusted to this that's not a good sign. It just means you've stopped noticing the wallpaper. Now, Frank noticed the wallpaper, and that was probably his main problem. And then there's this thing that David Graeber spent years writing about, which is the phenomenon of people doing jobs they privately know are completely useless. And they're not necessarily hard jobs or underpaid jobs, but they're jobs that, if they were to disappear tomorrow, nothing of actual consequence would change. I've had jobs like this. You've probably had jobs like this. And, you know, the person doing these jobs, they know this. They're well aware. So Graeber called them, appropriately, bullshit jobs, which was the title of a book he wrote about this. And his point wasn't just that they're demoralizing, which they are. His point was that this is probably intentional, and that keeping people busy and economically dependent and too tired to think too hard about what they're doing or why, that's a feature, not a bug. I think about Frank in that context. 40 plus years of showing up, and somewhere in there, the showing up just stopped being connected to anything that felt real or even remotely meaningful or purposeful in any way. And the system's answer to that disconnection was basically, well, here's something to take the edge off. Which of course, only works so long before the Edge starts winning anyway, because, you know, it always does. Okay, so Mark Fisher had this line about how it's become easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And I've mentioned this line several times in my videos because it's relevant to some of the major issues that we're dealing with these days. And I think he was right, and that particular imaginative foreclosure is its own kind of violence. Because if you genuinely cannot picture an alternative, well, then you stop looking for one. And then the hum just becomes like background noise that you manage however you can. And Frank managed it however he could. I'm not sure that there's a clean answer to any of this. I mean, I'm suspicious of clean answers anyway, especially nowadays. But I think maybe the smallest version of something like a real answer is something like, stop calling the people who hit the wall first defective. Because I don't think Frank was actually defective. I think he was early to this whole situation. And the thing about being early is that it doesn't stay early forever. The researchers, you know, they're still in the building where they've got the first round of data, and they're looking around the room for what to try out next. I think one of the unglamorous things we should maybe consider doing is just occasionally stopping participating in the efficiency of our own extraction. And I don't mean that in some big manifesto way. I mean in a very small and unassuming way. Like, do something outside of the algorithm's manipulation. Like, for example, just do something like go touch grass, preferably in the woods, somewhere in nature, far away enough from anything electronic. Maybe do something unexpectedly kind for someone in the analog realm, like sending a real letter to somebody. And then do it without expecting anything in return. Just try to have a conversation or take a photo or make something that doesn't have to get summarized into a post online. And just sit somewhere without your phone and let that discomfort and the withdrawal of that just be what it is for a while. And look, I know these are laughably small things given the scale of the problem, I get it, but I think the laughably small stuff that's done with that specific intention, it's a different category of small, because the thing is the establishment requires your total optimized attention to function, right? And every time that you just don't give it that, something slightly different happens to your nervous system and in your brain chemistry. And nothing too dramatic or anything. It's just something like a small recalibration toward a thing that's actually yours, outside of the proverbial matrix. And I think it's got to start there before it can lead to anything bigger. The other thing and I think this one matters more than it sounds, is just, you know, learning to recognize the pattern. Because once you can see the architecture of the thing, you stop being like a subject inside of it, and you start being an observer of it. And observers are, I think they're considerably harder to manipulate than the people who believe that their anxiety is a personal defect. I think Frank saw the architecture, and that's partly what made him so exhausting to be around sometimes, but it's also what I think made him interesting. He had like an awareness about these things. And he stopped blaming himself for the gap. And not that it really fixed the gap, but it changed something about how he stood inside of it. I'm not saying, you know, that's enough. It's probably not enough, but in any case, for all his shortcomings, I don't think Frank was truly defective. And I think that's probably true of a lot of people, in my humble opinion. Unfortunately, none of this is getting easier for anyone, because the jobs that used to at least offer the dignity of being real jobs, not meaningful jobs necessarily, but at least somewhat stable, you know, like something you could build a life around, those are obviously disappearing. Or they're getting automated or gigified or whatever, just eliminated altogether. And the wealth that used to at least circulate in some recognizable way, semi-functional way, that's been concentrating upward at a speed that would have seemed like satire 20 years ago. Because now we have a handful of people who hold more wealth than the bottom half of the country combined. And I'm not sure what to do with that statistic. I think you just stare at it incomprehensibly for a minute. And I think the honest thing to say is that the version of independence that Frank was trying to hold on to, the idea that if you just worked hard enough and you kept showing up, you could, you know, maintain some basic autonomy over your life, that version, it's getting a lot harder to access for more people. And it's happening faster than anyone's really able to process. I think we're in a state of denial. But people are waking up to what's happening. And they're realizing that the system isn't really broken. It's working exactly as it was designed. It's just that the design, of course, was never really for Frank or for most of us. And the new version, the AI-operated, algorithmically optimized version, that isn't for Frank either, or for most of us, if we're being honest about what's, you know, where this is all going. So I think we probably got to find another way. And right now, I don't know exactly what that is, but I think, well, you know, when I think about this, I feel that it should involve smaller self-sustaining communities that share resources and duties and don't rely on corporate capitalist modes for survival. I don't have a problem with capitalism at the cottage industry scale, you know, without all the ubiquitous corruption. I've been getting more interested in the solar punk stuff, but that's a whole other video, which actually I've already made here in this channel. Maybe I'll leave a link for it here at the end of this monologue, in case you're interested in what that's about. All right, well, I think that's all I've got today. As ever, thanks for listening.